For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a great pleasure on the morning show when I get to reconnect with a fine author. I have that pleasure today with David Barron, an award-winning author, journalist, and broadcaster. We spoke way back in 2003 about a fascinating book of his called The Beast in the Garden. Today, we talk about a very important book, and it is timely because it is just ahead of a dramatic total solar eclipse that will be occurring on April 8th. The book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. In this book, which actually was written several years ago and has just been re-released with a new afterword, David Barron explores his own fascination with that phenomenon of the total solar eclipse and his life as an unapologetic umbrophile or eclipse chaser, but then focuses very specifically on a total eclipse that occurred in the summer of 1878, a total eclipse that captured the imagination of many Americans, and three in particular, who pursued it with a ferocious interest. And it's a story very much rooted in its time, and yet that speaks to us very powerfully and directly in the 21st century. And David Barron, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, Greg, it's my pleasure. It's so nice to talk to you again.
So I love the fact that this book is not just about this particular solar eclipse in 1878, but is also, to some extent, about your own fascination with this particular phenomenon. Explain to our listeners briefly, I'm afraid, your initial encounter with a total solar eclipse and what that experience was like. I think that was back in 1998.
That's correct, yeah. And as you say, the book is largely about a total solar eclipse from the 19th century, but I frame the book with my own experience. And it all started for me in Aruba in 1998. I was working as a science correspondent for NPR at the time, and I went down there to see my first total solar eclipse. And I went into it thinking, you know, as a science journalist, that this was going to be an interesting astronomical event to witness in an intellectual sense. And what just completely bowled me over was my emotional reaction. A total solar eclipse truly is the most awe-inspiring spectacle in nature. And for me, as soon as the moon completely blocked the face of the sun, I felt like I was standing on another planet. I was looking at a sky I had never seen before. I was looking into the center of the solar system, seeing the sun and the planets together, and I just felt this visceral connection to the universe that I'd never felt before. I tell you, it's addictive. I have now seen 8 total solar eclipses on 5 continents, and the one on April 8th will be my 9th.
Very good. You write, to experience a total eclipse is like falling through a trap door into a dimly lit, unrecognizable reality. The most prominent object is thoroughly foreign. You may know intellectually that it is both the sun and the moon, yet it looks like neither. I'd never stopped to really think about that, that it isn't as though this strange foreign object has suddenly entered the sky. It is these two very familiar objects are suddenly sort of interposed on one another and are transformed. and into something that one has never seen before. And I just never stopped to think about how that in and of itself makes this such a distinctive experience and maybe in some respects utterly unique. I mean, I can't think of another experience that exactly mirrors it.
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, I think the word eclipse itself is kind of misleading because, you know, an eclipse suggests that something is hidden. And, of course, the sun is hidden. But the remarkable thing about a total eclipse is what is revealed. It's during a total solar eclipse that in the middle of the day, the blue sky gets stripped away. And the blue sky is essentially a curtain that keeps us seeing what's overhead at any other time during the day. And when that blue sky gets ripped away, you actually get to look into outer space toward the center of the solar system. And yes, the bright surface of the sun is hidden, but that enables you to see what's right around the sun, and that is the solar corona, which is just gorgeous. So it is so much about the experience really is unique. I mean, it's the colors of the sky, it's the seeing the solar corona, it's seeing the sun and the planets together. It's just mind-boggling.
Hmm. So you have had this experience repeatedly as what you call an unapologetic umbrophile, someone who chases eclipses all around the globe. If I remember correctly, you have witnessed 8 total solar eclipses in all in various parts of the world. I wish we had time to go into some detail about this, but at least in brief, can you describe how different those various experiences have been from each other?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I sometimes think that chasing eclipses is sort of like the world of deadheads, people who would go around and see the Grateful Dead from concert to concert. And you wonder, why do these people need to see the same band play over and over again? And they would tell you, well, each concert's different. The lineup of music is different. The crowd is different. The venue is different. And that's true for total eclipses, too. The eclipse itself is different. The solar corona looks different each time. Sometimes the moon's shadow makes for quite a dark sky. Sometimes it's not as dark. Sometimes you'll see a bunch of planets. Sometimes you'll see few. Seeing it in a big city can be a wonderful experience. Back in 1999, I witnessed a total eclipse from Munich, Germany, and I was on the top of a high-rise hotel downtown, and I could just see people everywhere on the tops of buildings and filling the streets and the parks. And when the moon's shadow raced in at 2,000 miles an hour, this collective cheer rose from the streets, hundreds of thousands of people at once. That was wonderful. Last April, I went to a remote corner of Australia, the middle of nowhere, to see a total solar eclipse that lasted all of 56 seconds. I was there. I didn't know anyone there, but I met up with some locals. We just went out to a remote area outside town and were looking out over this, this desert landscape. And that was wonderful. I mean, to just sort of be alone with a few other people and the universe. So each time is different. Each one is special. There's no wrong way to see a total eclipse except not to be in the path of totality. You need to be in the path to see it, and you need clear skies.
Hmm. One of the specific things you take time to mention really made me smile, because this is something I remember reading about many, many years ago, decades ago, and I don't know the last time I thought about this phenomenon called Bailey's beads. And that is something, even when someone sees repeated total solar eclipses, that doesn't necessarily mean you will see this particular thing. For the sake of our listeners who maybe have never learned about this or have completely forgotten about this, say a quick word about Bailey's beads and how thrilling it was for you to finally see them.
Well, so Bailey's beads, which are named after a British astronomer, Francis Bailey, who in the 19th century figured out what causes them, they occur at the very, just before a total eclipse begins and just after a total eclipse ends. So when the sun is shrinking, as the moon has shrunk the sun into a very thin crescent, and that crescent keeps shrinking, then the crescent breaks up into these tiny little dots that are kind of strung together like beads on a bit of a necklace. And at the other end, when totality ends and the sun starts to come out again, you don't all of a sudden necessarily see a crescent sun. You'll see these beads of light that then fuse together. And what Francis Bailey figured out is what you're actually seeing is sunlight filtering through valleys on the edge of the moon, because the moon isn't a precise circular shape. It's got these little notches in it, and those notches allow the sunlight to come through first. And they are quite dazzling. I've only seen them a few times of the 8 total solar eclipses I've seen. It may have something to do with my eyesight or when I'm actually taking off my eclipse glasses, but they are quite dazzling to see.
I appreciate the fact that you take a little bit of time in the book, not too much, but some time to kind of help us understand the nature of eclipses and also the fact that there are different types of eclipses. And I think knowing something about that helps us appreciate kind of the singular, spectacular nature of a total solar eclipse. Can you just summarize, kind of without even needing to go into detail about each, but just kind of give us a sense of just how complicated the story is of just solar eclipses in general, and then what makes a total solar eclipse both a rare and especially amazing event?
Right. So there are, in terms of solar eclipses, there are partial eclipses, there are total eclipses, and then there are also what are called annular eclipses, which have now popularly come to be called ring of fire eclipses. And we had one of those in the U.S. back in October. Most of the United States saw it as a partial eclipse, and that included Wisconsin. But along a certain path in the Southwest, if you were right in the middle of that path, at its peak, the sun was turned into what looked like a wedding band in the sky, a very thin ring. You couldn't look at it with the naked eye, but through eclipse glasses, that's what it looked like. And that's because the moon's orbit around the Earth is not circular. It's elliptical. It's sort of a little bit of an oval. And at times, the moon is a little farther away, and sometimes it's closer. And if the moon goes in front of the sun when it's a little farther away, its apparent size in the sky is smaller, and it can't quite cover the entire sun. And that's how you end up with an annular or ring of fire eclipse. But a total eclipse, like the one that's going to happen on April 8th, requires that the moon be closer to the Earth at the time that it passes in front of the sun. And therefore, it will look big enough to fully cover the sun. And that is a fundamentally different experience.
Right. So explain exactly when total solar eclipses occur. They obviously do not occur at regular intervals. And to kind of look at, for instance, when you have witnessed these, there would seem to be no rhyme or reason to them at all. And of course, I'm sure that's not the case. But kind of help us wrap our heads around when these occur and kind of what makes it, in a sense, kind of a moving target.
Right. Well, it's interesting because if you look at a map of total solar eclipses over time, there are these weird snaking paths across the globe, and they seem to have no rhyme or reason, or when they occur seems to not. But actually, there are some interesting patterns. So first of all, both solar and lunar eclipses return after an 18-year cycle. So 18 years and about a week after an eclipse occurs, that in essence, that same eclipse will occur again 18 years and a week later. And that's called the Saros cycle. And that was discovered long ago, even before anyone knew what caused eclipses. These early astronomers or astrologers figured out these cycles. And then it just has to do with the alignment of the various celestial bodies, that after 18 years, the sun, the moon, and the Earth basically come back to the same position. But that doesn't mean that the total eclipse will occur in the same place on Earth. It'll come back to Earth, but it will be shifted a third of the way around. It's a little complicated to explain without showing diagrams.
Sure.
But there are these interesting cycles. And so eclipse chasers will often talk about seeing the same eclipse after return. So for instance, the total eclipse I talked about that I saw in Munich that was 1999. The total eclipse that crossed the United States in 2017 was in essence the same eclipse. And if you look at its path across the globe, the shape is the same, but it got shifted from Europe to the United States.
Interesting. Again, to highlight for folks, you witnessed your first total solar eclipse in Aruba in 1998. Then you saw one in Munich in 1991. And then there's a few years that go
99, yeah.
Yeah, and then Australia 2012, North Atlantic 2015, Indonesia 2016. So sometimes if one is willing to travel around the globe, as you have been, one can actually witness total solar eclipses even more often, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know people who've seen 20 total eclipses or more. I'm still a little bit of a newbie, having seen only 8. And, I saw my first in 98 and then one in 99, and they were both spectacular. But, you know, I had other things to do in my life. I had other priorities. And honestly, it wasn't until my mid to late 40s that and this is getting a little personal, but, my mother died quite young. My mother died at age 48. And, I was quite young when she died. And I knew that was young, but when you're in your early 20s, you don't realize just how young 48 is. Hmm. And when I was getting to be that age and realizing my mortality, not to say that means I'm going to, well, I've lived now much longer than she did, but, I realized, well, it made me think about what's important in my life. And those eclipse experiences were right up there of things that meant a lot to me. And I decided to make it a priority and to start chasing eclipses again. So now, if I reasonably can, if I can get to wherever a total eclipse is, I'm going to go. And so now I'm pretty much going to everyone I can.
Hmm. Several years ago, a very substantial solar eclipse was visible right here in Wisconsin and through much of the Midwest. Again, I should have looked back to research it. I neglected to do that. But it was a very substantial event that got a lot of people very, very excited. And as it turns out, we had very heavy cloud cover here in southeastern Wisconsin. And although a large group of people gathered at Carthage College, where I teach, to view it as best we could, it was, of course, ultimately a deep disappointment. It was not what any of us were hoping for. And I wonder, for you, as you have chased total solar eclipses all around the world, how much have you had to do in terms of just looking at the plain old weather forecast? I mean, and to what extent has that ever been a complication in terms of the total solar eclipses that you have ultimately been able to witness in all their full glory?
Right. Well, that is always a key consideration. And so eclipse chasers will always be looking well in advance at climate statistics to figure out, okay, so along this path, where can I go where I have the best odds of seeing clear skies? And so most eclipse chasers will go to the place that, looking historically, probably will have clear skies. But that doesn't mean anything for eclipse day. You could have great statistics, but a storm comes through or one cloud gets in the way. So then a few days in advance, you start looking, very closely at the weather forecast. And if your original plan about where you were going to be doesn't look so good, you might shift. Back in 2015, the total solar eclipse was going to be visible only two places on land on Earth. And that was in the Faroe Islands, way up in the North Atlantic, and Svalbard, which is up in the Arctic, off of northern Norway. And so eclipse chasers were debating whether to go to Svalbard or the Faroe Islands. I went to the Faroe Islands because I was going on my own, not part of a tour, and to go to Svalbard, they say you need to arm yourself with a shotgun if you're going to leave your hotel in case you encounter a polar bear.
Wow.
So I wasn't going to go there. So I went to the Faroe Islands, but the Faroe Islands are notoriously stormy. But there was no place else to go, so that's where I went, and I was watching the forecast. And the weather was, it was just a downpour the day before the eclipse, but the forecast was for clearing skies. The question the next day, the question was whether the clearing would occur in time. And so I went to my chosen spot, and it was clearing offshore, but cloudy overhead, and clouds were still blocking the sun. And the partial eclipse began, and I couldn't see it. And I could see the light changing offshore where it was clear, but it wasn't, you know, I couldn't see the sun. Then totality began. Well, for 3 seconds, a hole opened up in the clouds, and I got to see the solar corona for 3 seconds. And given the terrible statistics and the bad weather, I counted myself quite lucky that I got to see it for 3 seconds. And so of my 8 total solar eclipses, I have never been completely clouded out. That was the closest call. So far I've been lucky all 8 times.
Wow, no kidding. And by the way, I just looked it up, and the event that I was talking about actually occurred all the way back in 2017. So that was essentially a total eclipse visible to much of the mid of the United States. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today with David Barron about his latest book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. The book primarily looks back at a particular solar eclipse, total solar eclipse, that was visible in much of the United States back in the summer of 1878. And one of the reasons we are talking with David Barron today is in anticipation of an upcoming total solar eclipse that will be visible to much of the country on April 8th of this year, 2024. David Barron, before we look at 1878, I wonder if we could just take a moment to kind of talk about this phenomenon of the total solar eclipse and how it has been viewed and understood throughout time, and particularly in earlier history, when scientific understanding of what this was all about would have been all but non-existent. I suspect that you, as someone who has experienced this quite a lot, has given a great deal of thought to what early human beings made of a phenomenon like this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even today, even though I know when the eclipse is going to happen, and I know that all that's happening is the moon is just passing in front of the sun, and the sun will be blotted out for a short time, and then it'll come back. There is still an element of fear, because you just realize that you are at the mercy of forces that are completely uncontrollable by man. But it's just so surreal. It's so unlike anything else. And so imagine if you didn't know it was going to happen, and you didn't know what was happening. So certainly in ancient times, I mean, these were considered tremendous omens. And this is why many monarchs would have court astronomers who really were astrologers, because if you were caught by surprise by some eclipse of the sun or moon, that could be seen as a very bad omen. And if an astronomer / astrologer failed to predict it, that may end up being the end of his life, in fact. But still, I mean, there are all sorts of, you know, ideas about eclipses that go back to ancient times. The ancient Chinese, who actually did know how to predict them to some extent, because, again, of this Saros cycle, the fact that they would come back, eclipses come back on this 18-year cycle, they knew when approximately they would occur, but they thought it was a dragon eating the sun, and whenever there'd be a solar eclipse, people would beat gongs and drums to try to scare the dragon off. And I believe in some Native American traditions, it was thought to be a frog eating the sun. But as I say, even today, when you know what's going on, it brings up all sorts of, I think, deep, instinctive thoughts. And it just is this very weird sense of it just not being natural.
Right. You you highlight a number of intriguing instances of this throughout early history, including the story of a certain Roman emperor who actually was so traumatized by the sight that he essentially stopped eating and died a few weeks later. I mean, just could not take all of this in. On a more positive note is a really beautiful quote you give us from James Fenimore Cooper, which I think says it so very well. He wrote or said, "Never have I beheld any spectacle which so plainly manifested the majesty of the Creator or so forcibly taught the lesson of humility to man as a total eclipse of the sun." And of course, he's speaking at a time when much more was understood about exactly what was going on, that in fact it was not the end of the world or the end of life as we know it. But even with some understanding, as you said earlier, this still remains a phenomenon that in a sense shakes us to the core of our being.
Well, and it, I think, connects people through the generations. I just love that quote from James Fenimore Cooper. It comes from an essay he wrote late in life, reflecting on this total eclipse he saw when he was a young man in his hometown of Cooperstown, New York. And late in life, reflecting back on his life, thinking about, you know, all the places he'd been and all the things he'd done, that event, that brief event from way back when, stood out as perhaps the most profound experience of his life. That is the emotional impact that a total eclipse has on many people.
So, of course, many total eclipses have occurred through history, but you found yourself drawn to one in particular, the total solar eclipse that was visible in much of the United States on July 29th, 1878. Of all of the, well, first of all, you made a choice to kind of focus on a particular eclipse, and then beyond that, to focus on this particular eclipse. Tell us about both of those choices in terms of shaping your wonderful new book, American Eclipse.
Well, thank you. So, so we talked about my first total eclipse experience in Aruba way, way back in 1998, and you know, it was personally just a profound experience. But then professionally, as a science writer, I just was struck that this is something I wanted to write about. I wanted to write for a general audience about the excitement and drama of a total eclipse. And I realized way back in 1998 that there would be two grand total eclipses in the United States in 2017 and again in 2024. And I figured I wanted to have a book come out in time for those two eclipses. And I was looking around for just a good eclipse story to tell, because I find the best way to convey information is through stories. If you can just find a really good human tale, I think that's the best way to communicate science to people who really don't care about science, is to find just a good human story. So that's what I was looking for. And I looked at a whole bunch of total eclipses in the 19th century, because the 19th century was a time when total eclipses were keenly important for astronomy. There were just fundamental questions about the sun and solar system. I mean, what is this great ball of fire in the sky? What is the sun made of? What fuels it? And there were certain studies of the sun that could only be done during a total solar eclipse, when the moon covers the bright surface of the sun, enabling scientists to look at what's right around the sun, including the sun's atmosphere. So whenever a total eclipse was predicted, pretty much anywhere on Earth, these grand expeditions would be put together to sail off to Africa or Asia or the Arctic. Astronomers would take along their telescopes and spectroscopes, and they'd set them up in the path of totality, wait for the moon's shadow to come in, hope clouds didn't show up, and then frantically conduct their experiments in just like 2 or 3 minutes during the total eclipse. So there's a inherent drama in this. And I was looking for the right eclipse story to tell. And given that I wanted to write for an American audience in particular, when I came upon the eclipse of 1878, it just had everything. Because July 29th, 1878, the path of the total solar eclipse crossed the American frontier, the Wild West. It went from Montana territory down to Texas at a time when the United States was an economic power, but we were really looked down upon by the Europeans when it came to intellectual pursuits. The Europeans considered themselves the center of Western civilization when it came to art and music and literature and science, too. But here was this key scientific event that was going to occur in America's backyard. It was our chance to show the world that we could compete in science. And it became a really important event for this young nation. And the federal government got involved, and dozens of great scientists went out to the Wild West for this event, and just a lot of wonderful characters. And again, I was looking for a human story to tell, and I just found so many really interesting historical characters to focus on.
Right, and we'll talk about each of them just a little bit. I want to just circle back for a moment to America's standing in the world at this point in the mid-19th century, because I think you really create a very interesting backdrop for this story that plays out in 1878 when you kind of talk about the, boy, it's you know, sometimes it's wariness, sometimes it's utter disdain with which many Europeans looked at this rapidly growing nation of the United States of America. I want you to comment on a quote that you include in your book from one British naturalist by the name of Thomas Henry Huxley, who writes this about this young United States of America. Mr. Huxley writes, "Size is not grandeur, and territory does not make a nation. The great issue about which hangs a true sublimity and the terror of overhanging fate is, what are you going to do with all these things? What is to be the end to which these are to be the means?" It's a fascinating quote, and it speaks to, you know, kind of a mix of maybe disdain and envy. I mean, about this relatively new nation with all of this potential, and yet at this point in time, seemingly not quite able to fully realize it or act upon it. What are your thoughts about this quote that you included from Thomas Henry Huxley?
Right, yeah. That quote got a lot of attention at the time, and it really did capture this both, as you say, kind of envy, but also fear that Europeans had about the United States. So here's this growing economic and eventually military power. How is it going to act on the world stage? And again, getting back to intellectual pursuits, there was an assumption by a lot of Europeans that America as a democracy run by just the rabble, the general population, that why would we ever care about intellectual pursuits like science? There was a sense that a democracy, you know, wouldn't want to invest in science. It was these old world monarchies or countries run by the elites. They're the ones who wanted to invest in science. So that gets back to the importance of a really public scientific event like the eclipse of 1878 that got the general public very excited about science. And, I mean, you read these newspaper reports, the general public really was excited about American scientists showing the Europeans that we were equal to them, if not better. And so, it's sort of like the moon landing of 1969. Here was this high-profile event that kind of imbued science with patriotism. It connected the two together. And I don't want to blow it out of proportion. You know, the moon landing was a bigger deal, but the eclipse of 1878 was one event of a number in the 19th century that helped propel us toward what we would become by the 20th century, which was the global superpower in science. In 1878, that was not at all predicted that we would become that.
Hmm. We're speaking with David Baron about his book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World, a book actually originally released back in 2017. It has been re-released in anticipation of the next total solar eclipse that much of the United States will be able to view on April 8th, 2024. Mr. Baron, you begin Chapter 1 actually not in 1878, but in summer of 1876, which, of course, any good American will recognize as the year of our nation's centennial. Tell us why you, in a sense, begin your book in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the summer of 1876.
Well, I wanted to set the stage for what was going to come. And so in 1876, it was our centennial, and in Philadelphia, there was the Centennial Exposition. This was a great World's Fair for the U.S. to show itself off. And it just so happened that the three main characters I decided to focus on, these three scientists of the many who went out to the Wild West in 1878 for the eclipse, all had connections to Philadelphia around that time. And so it was just, it made for an opportunity for me to create a scene. I mean, I like to, in my books, to write, as I think I have it in my head as if it's a movie. Just, you know, I like scenes and characters and drama. And so here was a scene that I could bring it all together. But so in 1876, at the Centennial Exposition, Thomas Edison is one of my main characters. He had one of his latest inventions being shown at the Centennial Exposition, the electric pen, which enabled you to in essence, make mimeograph copies of things. You would write something with this pen, and it would kind of make out a stencil that you could then make multiple copies of what you were writing. Second of the folks I write about, an astronomer named James Craig Watson, was actually involved with looking at and judging Alexander Graham Bell's new telephone, which went on display at the exposition. And so this was an opportunity to introduce him as a character. And my third main character was a female astronomer, Mariah Mitchell from Vassar College. And she was in Philadelphia around that time giving a talk about the need for women in science, if you can believe it. She was way ahead of her time. But in 1876, she was talking about how science should open its doors to more women. And that becomes an important theme in my book.
Right. Let's just touch a little bit on each of these three primary figures, each of whom is so incredibly interesting. And let's begin with the name that will be the most familiar of the three, of course, Thomas Alva Edison. This story is unfolding at an interesting point in Edison's life and career when he has been called by someone the professor of duplicity and quadruplicity. and you say he was so anxious at this point to demonstrate, in your words, that he was a scientist and no mere tinkerer. Tell us just a little bit more about why this particular part of Edison's life and career was especially crucial.
So we tend to think of Thomas Edison today as this iconic inventor, this old man with gray hair, but this is a different Thomas Edison. This is a young Thomas Edison. He was 31 years old, in 1878, so he was 29 in 1876. So he was still just trying to prove himself, and he clearly was having success as an inventor. He had yet to have his breakout success. That would come just a little bit later. But he also, at that stage in his life, thought of himself as a scientist. He was not formally schooled, but he wanted to be taken seriously by academic scientists, and he wanted to make important discoveries about nature itself. But he was not being taken seriously that way. Hmm. And so by 1878, at the time of the total eclipse, he had suddenly become a global celebrity because at that point he had just invented the phonograph, which was his first huge hit of an invention. And so, but he then decided to go out to see the eclipse in 1878 to do his own experiment, to do his own, make his own observations. And he came up with a new invention called the tazimeter, which was an extremely sensitive heat detector, like an electric thermometer, really an infrared detector, that he would use to point at the solar corona, this beautiful aura around the sun that appears during a total eclipse, to see if it gave off heat as well as light. And he was traveling with these academic scientists, and he hoped he would make his name, again, as more than an inventor at that time.
Hmm. A name much less familiar to our listeners, completely unfamiliar to me, is James Craig Watson, whom you call at one point in your book a man keenly representative of his era. Explain how Watson, such a fascinating guy, was in a sense a perfect embodiment of what this young nation, and especially in the scientific realm, was like at this point in time.
Well, he was a very ambitious man. He pushed his way on through everything, which sort of was the view of America overall. He was very interested in getting rich. He had a bunch of side businesses, as well as he was a professor at the University of Michigan. He actually had been accused of plagiarism as well, and kind of cutting corners when doing his research. But he was, he definitely was a very accomplished astronomer. He was best known in that era as a planet hunter, because back then, asteroids were considered planets. They were called minor planets, but they were given names just like the major planets, and there hadn't been all that many found. And finding asteroids, which are, you know, small bodies that orbit the sun just like the major planets, finding them was a very big deal. And so there was this race on to see who could find the most asteroids. So in 1878, he decided to go west for the eclipse to look for a planet. And in this case, not just another asteroid, but another major planet, and one that many astronomers believed existed, but no one had ever seen reliably. And that was a planet called Vulcan, which, if you look at solar system charts from the mid-19th century, you will see that the solar system, today the solar system goes from the inside out, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. Back then it went Vulcan, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. So Vulcan was a planet that astronomers thought had to exist because Mercury's orbit didn't make sense otherwise. Mercury behaved as if there was some mass between it and the sun tugging it along. And so astronomers guessed that it existed. They gave it a name. No one had ever reliably seen it, but that really wasn't a surprise. If you have a planet that close to the sun, it's going to set with the sun. It won't be in the sky at night, and you can't see it in the daytime. It's going to be lost in the sun's glare. But maybe during a total solar eclipse, when the moon completely blocks the sun, if there's a planet right near the sun, you would see it. And James Craig Watson was determined to find Vulcan. And so that was his aim for the eclipse of 1878.
Fascinating. By the way, I love a line you say about James Craig Watson, you know, very, very ambitious guy and well aware of his own gifts. And, you know, some would probably call him pompous. You wrote, but you write, his vanity was not without foundation, which is such a diplomatic way of putting it. And of course, we have to talk for a minute or two about Mariah Mitchell, the woman who was part of this trio, and an extraordinary woman. And she was also in Philadelphia in this summer of 1876, presiding over a women's congress and speaking out forcibly on, among other issues, what she thought should be women's rightful place in the arena of science. Tell us more about just how diligently and relentlessly she worked towards this important goal.
Yeah, well, Mariah Mitchell really did inspire generations of women to go into the sciences. You know, here she was at a time when there were very, very few professional roles for women. And when Vassar College was founded, she was hired on. I think she was the first faculty member, in fact, although it wasn't at all assumed that, you know, there would be women faculty like her in that role. But she was hired, and she, you know, encouraged young women to go into the sciences. Although at that time, you know, you have these brilliant women who would study the sciences, and then they'd get out and what jobs were available to them. There was hardly anything. You know, a scientifically educated woman might get a job as a school teacher, but it was very hard to get a job doing real research. Well, Mariah Mitchell wanted to change this as much as she could, and so she was out there campaigning for women, and as I write in my book, she did something truly remarkable in 1878 to try to help change the public's mind about this. So in 1878, there were dozens of men putting together eclipse expeditions from the East to go to the Wild West for the eclipse. Many of them were helped by the federal government. They were being paid by the federal government. The federal government was offering logistical support. Women were excluded. And Mariah Mitchell took it upon herself to put together her own all-female expedition to Denver in 1878. So she brought along her sister Phoebe and several recent graduates from Vassar, and they on their own went out to Denver with their telescopes to make their own observations. But it was a scientific expedition like the ones that the men were doing, but there's a whole other layer to it as well, which is it was kind of political theater to demonstrate to the American public that women could be scientists.
Hmm. By the way, I think one of my very favorite moments in your wonderful book is a quote from Mariah Mitchell and her statement she made at this Women's Congress in the summer of 1876 about the place of women in science. And you tell us that she chose not to argue that men and women were the same. In fact, she took the contrary position and she said this, the words of Mariah Mitchell: "Women are needed in scientific work for the very reason that a woman's method is different from that of a man. All her nice perceptions of minute details, all her delicate observation of color, of form, of shape, of change, and her capability of patient routine would be of immense value in the collection of scientific facts. When I see a woman put an exquisitely fine needle at exactly the same distance from the last stitch at which that last stitch was from its predecessor, I think what a capacity she has for astronomical observations. Unknowingly, she is using a micrometer. Unconsciously, she is graduating circles, and the eye which has been trained in the matching of worsteds is specially fitted for the use of prism and spectroscope." She is saying something so profound and powerful, and I'm so glad that you include her testimony. Well, your book, of course, goes on in remarkable detail to highlight this extraordinary exhibition into the heart of Colorado for these scientists to witness this total solar eclipse. We leave it to our listeners to explore that extraordinary story on their own. Just summarize the difference that it ultimately made in terms of America's scientific stature in the world, this expedition that these three and others undertook.
Right. Well, as I said before, I mean, it was an event that just rallied the American public around science and helped elevate science in the public consciousness. And so these individual characters all did make a difference, not necessarily in the way they intended. Clearly, Thomas Edison did in huge ways. But, even though he did not go on to be known as a scientist, he is known as an inventor. It was around that time when he was spending time in the West with scientists. This is a little known fact. He was the original founder of Science Magazine, which is like the premier scientific journal in the United States. Thomas Edison started that right after he came back from the eclipse of 1878. James Craig Watson, although he didn't live much longer, he, as I said before, he actually was very good at getting rich in his lifetime. And in his will, he left a legacy for himself. there's a medal that's still given out by the National Academy of Sciences in his name. It was one of the very first scientific prizes given out in the United States. Again, something to help encourage people to go into the sciences. And Mariah Mitchell, she really did just open up the doors of science. Again, it wasn't a sudden opening of doors, but she was the next generation of the women that she taught, then became in some cases professors, and then the women that they taught And down the line, she began sort of getting women into astronomy and the sciences. Mm. So these characters, the event itself, the ripple effects can be seen even to today.
Mm. The book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World, recently re-released by W.W. Norton and Liverite Publishing, and the author, David Barron. David Barron, congratulations on an absolutely marvelous book. What a privilege to speak with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes. Wow. We look forward to that. You're listening to WGTD